Welcome to The Bookshelf. Tonight, we continue our retrospective series with Todd Marshall, outgoing poet laureate of the state of Washington. For the past 2 years, Todd has been traveling around our state, visiting people of all ages in all corners of Washington. In the last 2 episodes, we talked to Todd about all the various events he attended and groups he met. But I still wanted to know, what does a poet laureate really do? What does it look like when the poet laureate visits a classroom or a meeting or a public event? I asked Todd, and his answer surprised me. Talking about all the events that you did at schools and at libraries and at public events, did you have sort of a template or a go-to message? You said it sort of evolved over time, but what was sort of the template for what happens when the poet laureate comes to town?
Yeah. I get these weird waves of existential creepiness if I find myself repeating myself over the course of a day.
Yeah.
And it freaks me out. And it's been something kind of ingrained in me since I began as a TA, actually teaching in grad school. Yeah. When I had to repeat the classes, I would lose, you know, if I lost track of, did I say this in this class or was that an earlier class? It would literally give me nausea. It's something that I try to avoid. It's impossible.
Yeah.
When you're visiting, you know, 6 or 7 classes in a row. But I always tried to spread an array of like possible directions that I might go at any of my visits, possible texts, possible poems, possible excerpts from Thoreau or historians that I might share with classes if that seems like it might be a better approach than poems. So I would have my huge bag of tricks, so to speak, and spread it out over the area that I was given to work in, and then just kind of organically feel where we might be heading as a group. Sometimes I felt like I navigated that okay. Sometimes I made huge mistakes and was left with awful silences and weird dynamics in the room. I am kind of obsessed with histories of Europe and the Holocaust, and so one mantra that I repeated again and again and again revolved around the historian Timothy Snyder and an anecdote from his book, Black Earth, The Holocaust as History and Warning. It's kind of a grisly and gruesome one, and I think that there were a couple occasions where the teachers, I would only share this in high schools, would the high school teachers would glance at me from the back of the room with a, what are you doing here? But I would tell the story of a Lithuanian teenage girl who found herself at the edge of a shooting pit. And she was naked there, standing, getting ready to be shot with dozens of other people and fall into the pit where there were already hundreds of bodies. And she fainted and just kind of fell into the pit, without being shot. And then another row of people were marched out and they were executed and they fell on top of her. And then another row of people were shot and they fell on top of her. And then before the earth was put on them, one of the soldiers would walk over the bodies and shoot down into the mass of flesh in order to shoot anyone. They would do that where they heard any noises. And this young woman was shot through the hand, but she lived. Then dirt was put over all of the bodies. And the soldiers left, and the young woman dug her way out through all of the bodies and then through all the dirt and came out bleeding and naked and went to a nearby cottage and knocked on the door, and she was turned away. And she went to a second cottage and knocked on the door, and she was turned away there. And then she went to a third cottage and knocked on the door, and she was turned away. The fourth cottage she went to invited her in and helped her, and she survived. The historian Timothy Snyder tells that story and asks the rhetorical question, who lives in the fourth cottage? And I find that a devastating and impossible to answer and yet so important to wrestle with question, because finally, at the end of the day, I believe that the arts and the humanities make it just a wee bit more likely that we might be people in the fourth cottage. That's one of my fundamental beliefs in this world. I don't know if it's naive. I don't know if it's silly, but it's something that I do believe. And so I think about that all the time, and I think about how the dynamic of inviting works of art inside of us, inviting characters and novels whose life experience is incredibly distant from our own, inviting those characters into our imaginative worlds, inviting the experiences and poems that we encounter that are quite distant from our own, all of that opening up of ourselves to texts maybe makes it so we're a little more willing to open ourselves up to the grave risk that would ensue by helping someone like that woman in that circumstance. I have to believe that. If I don't believe that, man, then what's the point? What's the point?
Yeah.
So that was kind of a go-to. The Yeats poem that I mentioned, The Song of Wandering Angus, I recited quite a bit. Yeats, The Second Coming, was kind of a go-to after I got tired of sharing that one. Gwendolyn Brooks' We Real Cool was a poem that I recited often, and that was a great entry point for talking about use of refrain and also, you know, talking about the delinquent behavior of the pool players, Seven at the Golden Shovel. My Papa's Waltz, another poem that I would often share. Audrey Rich's Aunt Jennifer's Tigers is another one that I had a lot of success with, actually, in Stevenson. We talked about that just yesterday. There's the line toward the end of that poem, the massive weight of Uncle's wedding band, line break, sits heavily upon Aunt Jennifer's hand. And that massive weight of Uncle's wedding band gives us a great chance to talk about hyperbole. Mm. And it gives us a great chance to talk about metonymy, where something's standing in for something closely associated with it. And that's a great poem for the getting the students to think about poetic devices. And that's one that I use quite a bit. But yeah, The Song of Wandering Angus is probably the one that I've recited more. And that's when things get really, really dead in a high school class. I can always go, oh, I'm going to pull up my sleeve, and there will always be a high school kid that says, "What does your tattoo say?" and so then I can recite Easter 1916 and talk about polite, meaningless words. And Yeats's repetition of that line twice in the poem, and how maybe there's nothing more important than avoiding the slip into just engaging other people with polite, meaningless words.
You're listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. I'm literary producer Chris Massini, and all this week we've been looking back at Todd Marshall's two-year term as Poet Laureate of Washington. One person who shared their experiences with us was Todd's friend Rick Nelson. Rick had the good fortune to ride along with the Poet Laureate during some of his travels around the state, and he shared some of his thoughts with me. It sounds like you had really cool experiences riding along with him, and that they were different from your expectations, or... So I don't know if you can necessarily articulate it, but what were your expectations? What were you thinking it would look like?
Well, I was not expecting as many activities during the day as we did.
Yeah, just the schedule, you mean?
Yeah, and it's pretty much a one-man show. It's not part of the teacher's lesson plan. The teacher's participating like a student, right? So that puts it all on Todd. And there are some writing activities, I mean, with high school students, but he's on, and a lot of it is exposition, and so it's a one-man show, and you're trying to take a 100-year-old poem and make that vital to somebody who's 17.
Yeah.
And he does that because he's smart, and he can tell you the details Like if he's doing Easter 1916, you're learning about history, and it was about a rebellion, right, that had long-lasting impact. So he's cunning and a great teacher. Yeah. But what else wasn't I expecting? Concentration of activity, but we were basically done at Inasotin, two morning classes, went to the park to a taco wagon for lunch, back across the street to the high school for the third class, and then we had from 2:30 until 5 o'clock when we met. I think it was the director of the Clarkston Library where the reading was going to be, and went to dinner. But that also then becomes another professional event, right? Yeah. Todd's on.
Yeah.
It's dinner and he's on. But that 2.5 hours, you know, he's an avid outdoorsman. So he wants to walk. Hmm. He wants to go hike and stuff. And I'm an avid indoorsman. So that was a surprise. Yeah. And then you have...
It sounds to me like just the level of energy that he gave to this position was really astounding. Like you said, the sort of amount of driving and the number of places that he went and the packed schedule. And on top of that, he also wants to go for a 2-hour hike in the middle of the day.
Probably healthy, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yep. Yep. Well, on the topic of, you know, stimulating imagination, I think this kind of ties in that bullying and accepting a status quo, in a sense, is a lack of imagination, right?
Yeah.
You think this is how things are. You never think about it differently. So Todd does this a metaphor-creating exercise. He did it with the high school students. He did it with the college students, that he says, okay, there are, you know, take the five senses, and for number 1 to 5 on your paper, and for each sense, write a little descriptor, like a skiff of frost on Palouse wheat fields. That's seeing. Bonfire pine smoke. That would be smell, right? So all the students have their five. Then he'll begin to talk about maybe WA 129 or one of his other topics. Then he'll come, after 5-10 minutes or so, he'll come back and he'll say, now list 1 to 5 and write a question, like a big overreaching issue, like what is love? What is conscience? What is hope? And he'll say, okay, put that aside. And he'll go back to talking about another poem. And then he'll say, okay, get out both of your lists. And at random, he'll point to a student and he'll say, what's your number 3 question? And the person might say, what is hope? And then he'll point to another student and say, what's your number 5 descriptor? And that person would say, bonfire, pine, smoke. And it would be, what is hope? Bonfire, pine, smoke. There's your metaphor.
Hmm.
Okay, so it's a great exercise because those students get it. Now they're creating metaphors. He's teaching them how to write poetry, and he's introducing them to randomness and chaos, and pull an order and letting the mind create. He's showing them that the mind can connect these ideas, these images that have never been put together before, that they weren't ever expecting to put together before. And that's kind of more interesting than a trite, love is a warm heart kind of metaphor.
Yeah.
It was a lesson. It was a ride-along, but it's...
Yeah.
If you're in the room, you participate. That's Todd is good at that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
In addition to sharing his own poetry and some well-known favorites, Todd Marshall used his platform as Poet Laureate to promote local arts and literature. He helped compile and publish an anthology of poetry called Washington 129, which collected one poem for every year of Washington's statehood. I asked Todd what other kinds of poems he liked to share on his trips, and he told me a touching story about a mysterious local poet known as the Bard of Sherman Avenue.
One of my jobs is at Gonzaga, I direct the Visiting Writer Series, and I want to say about 10 years or 12 years ago, we hosted Jane Hirschfield for the Visiting Writer Series. And so I was introducing Jane, and in my introduction, I made some crack about being a Jayhawk. And a few weeks later, I got an email from a man named Tom Wobker, who said that he went to the University of Kansas also. He attended it right after he finished serving in Vietnam, and he'd like to get coffee sometime and just talk about writing and talk about poetry. And I said, okay, cool. And we got coffee a few weeks later and became friends. He also shared some of his writing with me. He was writing a number of historical pieces about Idaho. Then a number of years ago, he came to me and said that he had cancer, and he wanted to tell me something that he hadn't shared with me before. And what he wanted to tell me was that he was the Bard of Sherman Avenue. I knew what the Bard of Sherman Avenue was because I get the Spokesman Review, and in it, there's a column called Huckleberries by Dave Oliveira, a Coeur d'Alene writer, and I would often laugh at these poems that were included in Dave's columns. And so I said, what the heck, Tom? I can't believe you didn't tell me that, for one, and then for two, we've got to share your poems with the world. How many poems did you write? And he said, well, I've written about 800 so far. And so I went, okay, well, you know, start sending to me. Here's a poem from the Bard of Sherman Avenue. The Curse of Oscar Mayer. The hot dog is a lurid meat comprised of eyeballs, snouts, and feet, and nameless organs pink and pasty. Yet even so, I find it tasty. Thoughts on a Canadian Goose. This is no doubt a remarkable species. One half is honk, and the other half's feces. His chemo was, obviously really, really difficult for him. And so several months later, some manuscripts started to come, and I started to cull through them, and I started gathering them into a manuscript, kept working on it, and it became obvious that I wasn't going to finish with the manuscript in time. Tom's sickness kept getting worse. And so you can read about this online. The Spokesman did a great piece on it. But we had a coming out of the Bard party in Coeur d'Alene where Tom Wobker was announced as the Bard of Sherman Avenue to everyone. And it was a really beautiful event. And you could see how many fans he had. So Tom passed a couple of weeks after that. And then a few weeks after we lost Tom, we finished a book manuscript of his. Several of his friends from college sent money to pay for the printing of the book, and we printed about 250 copies to start. And I asked his wife, Sharon, to whom she would like the proceeds to go, and she asked that the proceeds go to the Hospice of Spokane. And so at nearly all of my events traveling around the state, I share some of the Bard of Sherman Avenue's poems. And just about 99% of the time, the Bard sells more books than Todd Marshall does. I'll tell you that right away. Space station residents to drink recycled urine. Were I to ride in a spacecraft through the vast cosmic scene, I'd be very certain to take my canteen. The way we live in Idaho. We all drive a Hummer, and we live on the lake, and we drop by the spa when we feel like a break. But it's been a great honor to share Tom's poems and to spread his sometimes hilarious, sometimes poignant, always very, very pithy works with people around the state. We had to reprint the book three times now.
Wow.
I think that we're approaching $4,000 given to the Hospice of Spokane.
Wow.
Through the sales of the Bard of Sherman Avenue's poem. So That's certainly been one of my go-tos, mm-hmm. and I've been incredibly grateful for Tom's friendship, for Tom's wit, and for the chance to share his work.
This is The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. We're spending this episode with Todd Marshall, outgoing Poet Laureate of Washington State. During his tenure in the Poet Laureate position, Todd took the time to distill a few of his thoughts on poetry, art, and human connection into a series of short essays he wrote for local newspapers. Here's Todd reading one of those essays.
So this is from an editorial that I wrote for the Seattle Times toward the beginning of my service as Washington State Poet Laureate. In my first months as Washington State Poet Laureate, I've participated in many events and heard poems by published and unpublished writers. I've seen audiences of a few hundred and audiences of nine, sometimes even less. I've witnessed joy and grief, as well as confusion and understanding on the faces of people around me. Poetry, art, can show us how we are connected to another person's version of what it is to be human, can allow for those moments when, as Elizabeth Bishop wrote, we take, quote, a sharp, indrawn breath, half groan, half acceptance. That means life's like that. We know it. Also death. It's sublime, really, to see a diverse group of people listening to one another, really listening, and then sighing, smiling, or from time to time, sobbing, sometimes all at once. I think that many people in Washington hunger for more of these encounters, glimpses into how others feel, think, and live, a sense of what Gwendolyn Brooks called life distilled. Why? I don't know for sure, but John Keats, a working-class poet from 19th century England, wrote about negative capability in a letter to a friend, and perhaps this concept is relevant. Keats thought that negative capability was necessary for creative thinking. It's a state where we are, quote, capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. So many cultural forces shove us toward immediate certainty, from quick trivia fixes via smartphones to the rhetorical bombast of talk radio. Fewer people seem willing to dwell in a cloud of unknowing, of maybe, could be, and I don't know. Think about the difficulty in saying, I'm unsure, let me get back to you on that in a few days. Or the last time that you heard, I don't understand this, but that's okay. I want to live with it for a while. Unsurprisingly, political discourse has regressed to literal brawling in arenas and rioting in the streets. Dialogue about race and gender is equally fraught. Czesław Miłosz, Nobel laureate, poet, and survivor of the Warsaw occupation, asserted that the great enemy of humanity was generalization, the quick answers that a Google or a Wiki might give. As long as instant certainty prevails, then the slick slide to generalization will be open, and that descent leads to misunderstanding and misdeed. Mystery and doubt can check reactionary thinking, and the arts can help us inhabit uncertainty. Unfortunately, arts funding in our country has declined precipitously. According to the National Assembly of State Arts Agencies, Washington is currently ranked 46th in the nation in state funding of the arts. Washington's per capita support is just 16 cents compared to neighbors, Oregon, 51 cents, and Idaho, 46 cents. The highest state, Minnesota, $6.26. The lowest, Arizona, zero. Time spent on the arts in classrooms is also declining. A 7-year-old study by Arts Washington told us that 33% of elementary students in our state are getting less than 1 hour of arts education per week, a number that I'm sure has only diminished since that report was issued. What if the prevalence of diatribes over dialogue connected to a lack of art in our lives? What if the ability to exist in a state of uncertainty, connected with poetry and the other arts, could foster empathy and understanding? What if listening to music and making sculptures, if engaging in creativity and experiencing creativity, would allow for a counter energy to absolutism, for an awareness of differences without judgment, for those sighs and sharp indrawn breaths when we can hear the mysterious rhythms of someone else's life? What if we tried an experiment during which every one of us spent daily time focused with the arts? I don't know the answer to that question, but I know that recently, at a poetry event in Olympia, I heard many readers share their poems. Readers performed high-energy raps. Others shared quieter poems about childhood. One reader quoted Emily Dickinson, another Kendrick Lamar. Everyone engaged perspectives not their own. Everyone sighed and laughed, breathed with half groans and half acceptance, which is, of course, the stuff of which empathy is made, a mysterious quality that seems harder and harder to find.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf on Spokane Public Radio. All this week, we're looking back on Todd Marshall's 2-year term as Poet Laureate of Washington. Join us tomorrow for our final episode, where we'll look forward to the future of the Poet Laureate program and what we can expect from Claudia Castro Luna, Washington's next Poet Laureate. For The Bookshelf, I'm Chris Massini. For more information on the Washington Poet Laureate Program, visit wapoetlaureate.org. The State Poet Laureate Program is sponsored by Humanities Washington and the Washington State Arts Commission.